Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sansare Mayujid, the host of the channel for today. And today we'll be talking to Professor Matthew King about his new book, Ocean of Milk, Ocean of Blood, A Mongolian Monk in the Ruins of the Qing Empire. Professor Matthew King is an associate professor in Transnational Buddhist Studies, Transnational Buddhism in the Department of Religious Studies at UC Riverside. His research primarily focuses on Buddhist thought and monastic life in Inner Asia during the collapse of the Qing and Tsarist empires and the birth of nationalism and state socialism. He has extensively published in various peer-reviewed edited volumes and journals, and we are about to hear more about his new book, which was published by Columbia University Press today. So welcome, Professor Matthew King, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and your journey.
Sure. Yeah. I think like many folks who come to Buddhist studies, I grew up in a way exploring Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetan areas and regions and travel and so on. And from the time that I was about 15 or 16, became very involved with Tibetan Buddhist communities in Ontario, Canada, where I'm from, where I grew up. And pretty early on, when I was maybe about 16 or 17, I became connected with some communities that eventually began doing relief work in Mongolia amongst Tibetan refugee communities in South India. And also in Kham or areas in eastern Tibet in the People's Republic of China today. And so through those connections, sort of relief work and just an interest in Buddhism and connections to Tibetan Buddhist communities, I had the chance to begin traveling to, you know, Buddhist sites in India and then eventually to Tibet, to Mongolia and elsewhere, and eventually found my way after my undergrad degree, accompanying a Lama through a teaching tour in Mongolia through the South Gobi and to Ulaanbaatar and meeting a generation of very old Mongolian Lamas like Gurudeva Rinpoche that sort of gave me a sense of the Buddhist revival happening in Mongolia, certainly in this kind of transnational context of Tibetan Lamas coming and giving transmissions and all this sort of rebuilding and so on. And at that point, I'd been working and training as an anthropologist and ended up doing a master's thesis on kind of like what I was understanding as Buddhist Bible camps in the Gobi for an emerging and very privileged group of kind of an emerging and very privileged demographic in post-socialist Mongolia, which was the urban middle class. And specifically the youth, the children of the emerging urban middle class. And these kids were sort of sought out by various lamas and taken down to the Gobi, for example, and taught what it meant to be Mongol, what it meant to be Buddhist, and definitely sort of mirroring Christian missionary tactics that have been going on since the early 90s. And then so through that, what I discovered was that the idea of the Mongolian Buddhist history, particularly in the early 20th century, was very important for contemporary religious life in Inner Asia, and was very interesting to me, but it hadn't really been studied. And that really led me to begin doctoral work, training in historical anthropology, and wondering about kind of religious social imagination in the modern remaking of Inner Asia, you know, revolution, nationalism, all this stuff. And that kind of is a straight line to this book many years later, I guess.
Mm. Yes, definitely. You are one of the few people in the world who work in the area of Inner Asia and Mongolia. And what were some of the challenges that you encountered when kind of initially choosing this project?
Well, there's two sets of challenges that come to mind, and those are challenges that I still face today in some ways. I mean, one is, look, you're working on a time of profound state violence that's within the living memory of communities today. And, you know, that's not something to be taken lightly. And the way that communities today choose to remember state suppression, state violence that wasn't coming from the outside necessarily. It was also, you know, Mongols killing Mongols and an entire apparatus of kind of suppression and violence that implicates families that are alive today who are victims as well as perpetrators. Mm. So, and the politics of remembering violence is, of course, something to be respected. And so, you know, the great difficulty with this project, and to be honest, my apprehension about how it will be received in Mongolia, is that it tells a very different story than a sort of hyper-nationalist one that is fondly remembered or invented today. And so there's those problems that I acknowledge in the book and try to think through. And then the other problem is, you know, getting at the traces of Buddhist life outside of state archives is a very difficult task. You know, most research that's been done on early 20th century Buddhist life in Mongolia, at least, has been sort of state-centric, right? Focused on state mm-hmm. archives, confessions, trial proceedings, party congress, you know, circulars and so on, right? Getting at what people thought and understood outside of the party is not an easy task, especially since in Mongolia, the destruction of monasteries, of monastic records, of texts, or at the very least, their profound displacement is massive. You know, so the idea of what an archive of the social and religious imagination of Buddhist monastics facing the collapse of the Qing, the nationalist and then socialist revolution, is itself, you know, a real hurdle, which is why, you know, Zawa Damdin, this very unique figure who is the protagonist of my book, is so exceptional, because he wrote 9,000 folios of texts, mostly during this period from, say, you know, 1910, a few texts a little earlier, till 1937, that fateful year of the purges and of his own death. And so there's nothing like it in the sense, in scale or scope, from any other mm-hmm. Mongolian monastic, at least that we're aware of now. And not only that, he engaged these new currents so deeply and personally, that, you know, we get a sense of something like a social history of knowledge as well. So those are the two hurdles, you know, just getting at sources, finding voices, as well as the politics of, you know, stumbling into memories of state violence. Yeah,
definitely. And that brings us perfectly to your book, with Zawa Damdin. Mm-hmm. So I love the book, and I've been following your work for a very long time. And just the way that the book is organized in these two parts is quite intriguing. And I guess it begins really with Zhao Damdin, this figure from the end of the Qing dynasty in Mongolia, who really marked maybe one of the last polymath of Mongolia in Buddhism. So, yeah, why don't you go ahead and take us through the book and the chapters?
Sure, yeah. Well, I should say, you know, something I tried to do in this book and that I try to do, like many other scholars of Buddhism, of course, is to make our work legible to a broader audience than just area specialists. And not only legible, but to actually make interventions into broader, you know, theoretical conversations. And for me, Zhao Damdin and his work and the social world that his work helps illuminate really challenges a lot of the standard narratives in the way that modern Asian history is told generally. And so the way that I start the book is with a vignette from a text that I found describing a figure who it ends up being Zhao Damdin, climbing up on a throne in a monastic college and delivering this long exegesis on prophecies given by one of the Qing emperors, who is considered to be the emanation of Manjushri. And you know, these prophecies have to do with, you know, a long history of essentially organizing global history around a unified secular and religious rule, the famous two systems, unified two systems, Chösi Sungjel in Tibetan, that really becomes dominant in certain representations of power in Inner Asia from the 17th century to the early 20th century, especially with the rise of the Dalai Lamas and the Qing, and it's sort of what Johann Elverskog calls the Gelug-Qing formation, the sort of representation of power and history and moral narratives and community that you know, really becomes widespread over the course of the Qing Empire. And here's Zhao Damdin climbing on a throne and sort of amplifying the message. But what's so interesting about the text is that it ends saying that this all happened in 1924, not 1824, not 1724, but 1924. So this is over a decade after the political end of the Qing. This is already a decade after, you know, the quote-unquote last Manjushri emperor is laying in hiding in the Japanese legation in Beijing, you know. This is already over 10 years after the national formation of Mongolia. And it's already 3 years into Asia's first experiment in socialism, the formation of the Mongolian People's Republic, right? And so why are there monks standing, climbing up onto thrones, talking, as the text says, to an assembly of monks and gods about what Manjushri has to say for them and about the global history of China, Mongolia, Tibet, India, Central Asia, sort of organized through the figure of the enlightened Manjushri emperor and the Qing? I mean, we could say, well, this is just some conservative monk out of step with reality. But there's an audience, you know? And so this opens the whole problem that the book tries to explore, which is that, you know, the nice, tidy periodizations of modern state formation, modernity, with heavy quotation marks, scare quotes, in Asia, of course, isn't a unilinear process. It doesn't just start through contact with Europe. It's not some slow rationalization of public space that is mutual and consensual, right? And so what I'm after in the book, through the sort of, in a kind of micro-historical way, through Zhao Damdin's eyes, is what is the otherwise of the modern in Asia, in Inner Asia? What is the otherwise of the nation, of the national formation, right? Of the national subject, which is being invented, a population, you know, the Mongols, the Chinese, history with a capital H. What are the affordances and the leftovers, the scraps of other ways of being in time and place that endured this grand experiment in making new societies accompanied by a lot of bloodshed in you know, Siberia, Mongolia, Tibet, China, and so on. And beyond that, what are the effects of those, what I call counter-modern formations, globally and transnationally since the purges, you know, in the way that the transnational Tibetan-Mongolian community, as well as sort of converts to these traditions all around the world, you know, what are the effects of those formations? You know, we know so much about Buddhist modernism, but what is outside of the nation, out of the modern? What's left outside? That's the problem that the book opens with. And in some ways, that's the problem that the book ends with. But this is my interest. And so, you know, I try to develop a sort of, I try to do two things which in the book, which is describe what the contents of the social and religious imagination were for, at least for Zawa Damdin and the nobility and monastics around him in the, beyond the political endings of the Qing. And I try to show how that was quite unique and beyond the normal narrative of modern formation. And then I also, though, try to exemplify a way of using a close analysis of Buddhist communities, of this sort of a sociology of knowledge and so on in these communities, in a way that I hope could be used to explore other contexts of these counter-modern Buddhists, you know, who Zawa Damdin, for example, never uses the word communism. He never talks about the Revolutionary Party. He never identifies a politician. He comes up with these vast global histories wherein Europe and science and...
So what does he use when he talks about these factions of people?
Well, so this is his, this is actually his problem, right? Which is the end of the Qing provides essentially a black box, which is, how do you reproduce Buddhist communities? How do you discuss and represent in, say, historiography and so on, population and shared histories? And how do you set the profound ruptures represented by the collapse of the Qing into time and place? And he spends 30 years doing that. And he's reading, and I guess I'll go through it, you know, chapter by chapter, but he's reading all the new currents of intellectual currents arriving with revolution in Inner Asia voraciously and critically, and in close conversation with Russian scholars, Finnish linguists and Orientalists, and he's reading French historical fiction. He's reading early Buddhology, early kind of science being brought into Inner Asia alongside the Abhidharma, the Kala Chakra, the Vinaya, and just, you know, and several centuries of what I call a sort of frontier multilingual Gelug scholasticism that sort of extends from Amdo into Hakha Mongolia and into parts of North China, the real frontier mediators that, you know, were working through for generations before Zawa Damdin, you know, amalgamating, you know, China, histories of Chinese Buddhism with Tibetan versions of the Buddhist dispensation, for example, like Gumbo Jab and so on, and a kind of synthetic scholasticism that Zawa Damdin brings into the post-Qing period. And brings them into conversation with everything from the Bakhtin circle to what is beginning to form as an academic discipline, which is like Oriental studies, Asian studies, and Buddhist studies. So he's engaging all of this stuff to come up with, essentially to diagnose the causes of the end of the Qing and to sort of sketch out what the implications were for someone like himself, who's an abbot, a leader, right at the very center of the first experiment of socialism in Asia. And, you know, he writes thousands of pages, but in the end, he can't quite make sense of it. And even though he can come up with a vast vision of history based on his readings, he can't come up with a compelling, cohesive narrative about how to move forward by his own admission.
It's almost, the internet booms for the first time and you have access to all this information and you're trying to make sense of it, but as a monk, a Mongolian right. Buddhist monk,
yeah,
and trying to make sense of it.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's just
more about Sawadandan. How did you find him? How did you get interested in all his texts and who was he?
Sure. Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that I had the opportunity to travel to Mongolia with some Tibetan lamas who were doing teaching tours. They were actually hosted by the current incarnation of Tsawa Damden, known as Tsawa Rinpoche today.
So, alive today.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Tsawa Damden's incarnation, who's a very prominent figure in Mongolia, a very prominent Buddhist figure. When I mentioned that I had done my MA as sort of ethnography of these Buddhist summer camps or Bible camps, essentially, in Mongolia, one of the main things they were reading were translations into Cyrillic or contemporary Mongolian of the previous Tsawa Damden's histories. So, and also, you know, part of the revival in Mongolia is Tsawa Damden's very prominent. He's sort of constructed as this nationalist hero, the last great polymath of Mongolia, both as a kind of modernist figure, because he was very engaged with new intellectual currents after the collapse of the Qing, but also as a kind of emblem of a definitively Mongolian Buddhism at its height, at its sort of like intellectual and institutional height. Again, my book actually contradicts all those narratives, but that was a prominent part of my first, you know, one or two or three times going to Mongolia. I mean, there's statues of Tsawa Damden everywhere. His image and his memory is central to the nationalist kind of Buddhist revival happening. So that made me think, well, geez, I should start taking a look at what he actually had to say. And it turns out he had a lot to say. Thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of things to say.
Goodness.
Yeah. So then, and one of the things, I guess, coming to the book is that he wrote a lot about himself. He wrote a lot about his autobiographical texts. And he also intrudes regularly into essentially everything else he wrote. I should say that Tsawa Damden, the 9,000 or so folios, I think is about 417 texts that I counted in his collected works today. Very few of them were actually printed during his lifetime. And most of them come down to us as photocopied manuscripts that were assembled in the 1970s by the Mongolian refugee community, especially Gurudev Rinpoche and so on. So these were texts that read still as drafts. There's interlinear notes. There's his voice is intruding. There's a lot of open-ended questions in the text. You know, the beginnings might be really well-formed, but they drift off at the end or there is no ending. It's essentially like looking at the notes of a scholar more often than it is looking at, you know, completed texts that have been cut into woodblocks or printed and edited and so on. So because of that, his own voice is so much a part of everything he wrote, whether he's writing about, you know, ancient India or this, what we call the Silk Road, if he's writing about Madhyamaka, if he's writing about, writing about the history of the Mongols or Chinggis Khan, or he's writing about the Qing or whatever he's writing about, he's so present in the text. He's regularly intruding.
Rare, isn't it?
Pardon?
And that's quite rare when it comes to Buddhism.
It is absolutely.
Voice.
Yeah, it is absolutely. And at the same time, he's definitely coming at the end of a 200 or 300 year blossoming of biographical and autobiographical writing across the Tibet-Mongolian interface, right? Of where biography and autobiography had just exploded in its scope and its length in terms of its the way folks were reflecting on appropriate the literariness of autobiography and biography and so on. So I think the idea that he should write about himself a lot was certainly expected, but it's so What's unexpected is how unguarded his statements about his life are, and how uncertain he is about his times and as well. And so I have two chapters in the book dedicated to his autobiographical writing, kind of gleaned from many, 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 many different places, where I kind of try to patch together his life, his education, and what it was to be a monk walking through the twilight of the Qing, to be formed at the height of a sort of Tibetan-Mongolian scholastic culture, and then to come into seniority just as that all fell away, and having to take control of monasteries and lineages and communities and so on, as you know, the state slowly gets itself together legally and otherwise to extinguish monastic life in Mongolia.
Mm. And what made you title the chapters the way you did? For example, part one, Enchantment; chapter one, Wandering; chapter two, Felt; chapter three, Milk.
Well, I guess what I wanted to do was essentially, though, what I was deciding to do with this book is to try to emphasize how Zhawa Damden's engagement in writing and interpretation of his times are open-ended and are unfinished, and they contradict one another, mm-hmm. as opposed to being closed and tidy, cohesive, and definitive. And because of that, I tried in my own writing to not add any more closure, to not impose my own themes too dramatically and so on, and to pick up on metaphors and recurring themes that he uses to write global history and write his own life, about his own life, over the 20 or 30 years or so of revolution that he saw and weathered and tried to manage, or at least tried to know. And so Wandering, for example, he organizes he has a dedicated autobiography that he writes when he's about 69 in 1936. So this is deep into the revolutionary period, just a few months, possibly just a few weeks really before his own death, and also before the escalation of state violence, where at least 40,000-50,000 monks are killed, and all the, you know, almost all of the 800 monasteries are destroyed, and thousands, hundreds of thousands of monks are disrobed, and so on and so forth, right? So the writing's on the wall. This is grim times. And from that vantage, Zhawa Damden writes about his youth. He's born in 1867 in the Gobi, and he writes about his entering the monastery, his training, the pilgrimages that he took, eventually taking over as a teacher and an abbot in his own right. And he titles each of those sections using the word yangpa in Tibetan. So like usually used to kind of talk about mental wandering, like distraction. So in a sense, he's sort of an expected level of humility for a monk writing about his life. Like this is my worthless life spent in distraction. You know, he kind of has this language. But also yangpa for me becomes the dominant theme of his life and work, because he wandered so far in his life. He wanders across the territory of the Qing. He travels to Omdo, to eastern Tibet, the kind of border lands, trains in poetry at the major monasteries around Xining City. He goes to Beijing. He goes to Wutaishan, right? He has all these visions. He has this dramatic, almost mystical series of experiences that he writes about using particular Tibetan-Mongolian genres. But he also wanders intellectually, right? Like he's wandering through the peak of scholastic life in the Eastern Tibetan-Mongolian areas in the Gelug tradition. He trains in all the classical texts, and he accomplishes, you know, these degrees and becomes this recognized debater and so on. But he's also an early member of the Mongolian, what becomes the Mongolian Scientific Academy. He's he's a sought after interlocutor for revolutionary leaders, all these Buryats and Siberians that are the poets of revolution in Asia, the first, you know, one of the, you know, who are translating Marxism and Leninism and Trotskyism and so on onto the steppes, into, you know, nomadic and pastoral communities, and inventing, you know, trying to translate Inner Asia into historical materialism and to all these other sorts of legal and social programs. And Zhao Adamdin's engaging them deeply. He's also like reading anything that's available in Mongolian or Tibetan from, writing from the Bakhtin circle to French historical fiction, essentially elementary schoolbook science that becomes scandalous, he has to take on. And so Zhao Adamdin wanders in all these ways. So he himself uses this language to describe his own peregrinations, I guess, as a person. And it seemed like a good way to organize talking about his life. And later on, he talks about himself wandering into uncertainty, into old age, wandering into needing to protect the monasteries. And that late autobiographical work in particular ends in a very kind of tragic, grim way where he's essentially escaping to the desert to go into permanent retreat. Gosh. And the monasteries have essentially been shuttered. And then I'm able through in the book to reconstruct his death and his burial from some archives I found in the National Library in Mongolia. And then the general organization of the book between this enchantment, disenchantment, it just seemed to me that this is the binary that Zhao Adamdin begins developing through his decades-long attempt to diagnose his times, essentially a slow, steady enchantment of the world, but, you know, and specifically Inner Asia, and then the disenchantment of the world as part of the collapse of the Qing. And I talk about enchantment and disenchantment in a very particular way in the book as essentially the arrival of the enlightened, of Buddhas, of Bodhisattvas, and so on, into the world as these sort of curators of security, abundance, the Dharma, you know, the sort of incarnation, the ideology of incarnation, which is by the early 19th century, of course, is just saturates Inner Asia, the Tulku tradition, and the idea that the enlightened were occupying not just religious positions, as say the Dalai Lamas, the Panchen Lamas, the Jepsen Dampas, and so on in Mongolia, but also political figures like the Qing emperors, like Chinggis Khan, you know, Chinggis Khan, like the emperors of the Tibetan imperial period back in the, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th century and so on. You know, the idea that the enlightened had regularly intruded onto the human stage, wrapped themselves in monk robes or the robes of an emperor, and curated civilization was essentially the dominant way of representing history from a literary perspective, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is essentially Zhao Adamdin's trouble, is that if all of history culminates in this grand golden period of the Qing, as 200 years of scholasticism before him had determined, well, what do you do when the Qing goes, right? What do you do when this quote-unquote enlightened, the incarnate lamas, like the last Jepsen Dampa, the eighth Jepsen Dampa that he knew, are essentially scoundrels, or else have evacuated, you know, their positions, or else they're being put on trial and shot. So yeah. For him, this is his problem. Like he's essentially faced with either extending the historical, this way of representing history, territory, agency, and authority that he had inherited from the Qing, or else it was his task to end it and talk about what is the end of history, what is the end of, and so on. And so I'm really especially interested with this idea of following his focus on tracking the events of the enlightened arriving into the human real, into upon the inner-Asian stage, because he's most interested in this not as a language of diplomacy, which other scholars have explored, not as a way of like representing icons, or not as a way of doing ritual, not as a projection of Qing power, as a way of kind of fooling Tibetans and Mongolians, but based in this idea that the enlightened are present and available to the human, Dawa Damdin, and I sort of suggest inner-Asian Buddhists generally by this period, understood an entire set of like reproductive possibilities, right? Of contact with these generally masculine, enlightened institutions, bodies, and this idea of contact, right? Of like gel and so on in Tibetan, with these purifying centers, whether it's a monastery, whether it's monks, whether it's monastic communities, and especially these incarnate lamas like Tulkus, Hutuktuk, and so on, right? Dawa Damdin essentially decides that this is no longer possible. So his whole way of constructing like the modern is that this set of reproductive possibilities, essentially global history itself, has come undone, right? And so how do you reproduce Buddhist life? How do you actually understand community and the direction of history and so on?
Yeah, so what does one do when everything you knew and have been taught just falls apart and there's not quite an alternative yet?
Exactly. And this is his task. And it's not just his own task. He's asked to write history, and he's known for his abilities, over the course of the revolutionary period, right? The Bolt Khan, who becomes the leader of the autonomous, this incarnate Lama of the eighth Jepson Dampa, who's raised as this leader of the Mongolian autonomous during the Mongolian autonomy period, which is like 1911 to 1919, the sort of theocratic nation state that broke away from the Qing in 1911, who Dawa Damdin thought was a scoundrel and absolutely detested. He drafts Dawa Damdin to write national history. Mikhail Tubianski, who's a student of Shcherbatsky, this famous Russian Buddhologist, writes Dawa Damdin, encouraging him to continue writing his histories of the Mongols, of Buddhism, and so on, since the writing was on the wall that these texts will become scattered in the wind, as he puts it, right? So he's like implored everywhere he looks, left, right, and center, to write history. And of course, when we write history, we're trying to shape the future, right? I mean, so really the argument I advance in the book is he turns to writing the past obsessively, just as the future becomes so uncertain for someone like him, who's not a revolutionary leader, who's in the scholastic colleges, and who's facing all of these profound changes long before, the idea of state violence was in the air, just the idea of social mobility, that everyday common people could take the reins of political power. The idea that science and scientific academies kind of associated with the West would be privileged by the state and would become competitors for the scholastic colleges, right? There's all these other shifts and ruptures that he and those around him, deal with. But we only know it through his eyes because we don't have other texts, really.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And when he's wandering through all of these new ideas that he's interacting with, do you get a sense maybe which ones that he's more partial to?
Yeah. So he's not conservative. I don't use the word conservative in any sense, because he's a deeply, deeply, deeply engaged thinker. Really a phenomenal mind, in the sort of dusty monasteries of Mongolia. And he's a voracious reader and interpreter of emerging scholarship, Western scholarship. He uses that word, Western or Europe, right? Scholarship about early Buddhism. So, I've found little tangents and asides in some of his works where he talks about going to an embassy in what's now Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia, where he was based, and looking at pictures of Silk Road excavations, like from Turfan perhaps, or Dunhuang. He doesn't say, but he's talking about these excavations. He's looking at pictures and scholarship on Khotan, which is so central to these really radical new interpretations of the deep history of Inner Asia, of Tibet, Mongolia, China, India, that he comes up with just before the end of the purges. Also, though, his kind of new interpretations of the Mongolian past, but also like the Tibetan past, the Turkish past, and so on, is buttressed. He finds evidence in like Western maps. He translates John Gustav Ramstad's work on the stele, like the stone inscription, Turkish inscriptions in Mongolia. This was published in Mongolian in the 19-teens, and Zawadamdin translates the entire scholarly article on the Turkic origins of the Mongols into his work. And so that origin story like dramatically contradicts the Qing narrative, which is that, the Mongols and the Qing and the Tibetans are all in this kind of continuity back to Chinggis Khan and the Tibetan, Yarlung Empire and way back to like prehistorical Indian kings, the sort of like nice cohesive cosmology that was developed in the Qing. Well, Zawadamdin's very open to abandoning that narrative because the evidence isn't there. And he's, takes a dramatic left turn seeing the Mongols as part of this like shared Turkic nomadic history. That text translated into Tibetan for posterity exists alongside, lives of the Indian Mahasiddhas and, prophecies from Tukul Drakpa Gyaltsen from the 16th century and all these other, this mosaic of sources to come up with this deep history. So he's very, very open and very interested in emerging, stuff we would call today Buddhist studies or Asian studies, Orientalist scholarship, archaeology, textual scholarship, and so on. What he cannot stand, though, in terms of new knowledge, is empiricism, science. Mm-hmm. This is something that he takes issue with from writing that was done in the 19-teens. So this is during the autonomous period, where there's these secular newspapers that are translating elementary science into Mongolian. Stuff about that the earth is round, evolution, physiology, what weather is, and so on, into this newspaper called The New Mirror, right? Shinito. And Zawadamdin is part of a revolt against these ideas. And so And this continues in his work right up until 1931 as the last example of him taking issue with what he calls the superficial intellectuals of the West. But what's so interesting, though, and what I make a try to emphasize in my book is that it's not that the cosmology of Western science, that, for example, the Earth is round, that it's a heliocentric universe and so on. He's not worrying that this representation of the world contradicts the Abhidharma, the Kalachakra, or whatever. As he says himself, his canonical sources about, his quote-unquote Buddhist sources about the nature of the world and the nature of all the different people who live in it, they themselves are contradictory, right? Yeah. Dramatically, very contradictory. But what his issue is how Western scholars, and specifically scientists, know the world, which he says is only through direct cognition, right? They only know the world and they only accept truths about the world through direct observation, sort of sensory observation. They neglect entirely inference, which of course is a privileged scholastic way of proving karma and rebirth, unseen truths about the world that are found in scriptural sources, right? Which scholasticism is so intent on proving. So the line in the sand for him and his scholastic milieu was science, empiricism, and so on. And also his other line in the sand was mixing the laity with monastics in monastic colleges. And so late in the book, I was able to reconstruct through various letters and things like that, how he was a very sought after voice, sort of authority, by all these people we would identify today as Buddhist modernists, Buryats in particular, including Agvan Dorjiev, is this famous figure, confidant of the 13th Dalai Lama, this diplomat, and a confidant also of Tsar Nikolai, and someone really trying to make Buddhism in Buryatia, especially survive the socialist period, the Soviet Union. In any case, all of these guys several of them are writing to Zhao Damden as they try to modernize the monastery, to rationalize it, to introduce science, to introduce Western scholarship about Buddhism into the monastery, into the monastic colleges, and to kind of invent this new character, which they kind of call the Black Lama, right? Like the Hara Lama or whatever, right? As a sort of pseudo-monastic, pseudo-lay figure who's studying traditional monastic knowledge, but also being trained in the European and Russian academy, as all of these Buryats, many of those Buryats themselves had been. Mm-hmm. And that's another line in the sand for Zhao Damden. And he cannot accept the social mixing of having the laity in sitting alongside the monastics, studying scholastic topics, and particularly the Vinaya, of course, like the laity aren't supposed to study the Vinaya. But just generally, as he says, it's like mixing water with milk, which I guess from for him or for Mongols, perhaps, this is like something you really don't want to do, right? It's like you're diluting the nourishing, life-giving continuity of the Dharma, right? And so, these things that have been so focused on is like, the quote unquote Buddhist modernist movements and reform movements and so on in these revolutionary contexts. I mean, Zhao Damden is just fiercely critical. And I translate those letters. You can get a sense of it in the book. That really points again to what I'm trying to get at in the book. Well, if not that, then what? What is going on in the ruins of the Qing against reform movements,
Some disenchantment and re-enchantment happening in all sorts of directions where
it's
really interested in all this new information and history and way of looking at the world that's coming in. But at the same time, he's also rejecting aspects of it, like the mixing.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And yet he has, and through it all, I should say, he has a scholastic impulse, one really carried over from the Qing, I say, the late kind of, well, let's say the 18th, 19th century Qing, of a sort of polyglot, synthetic Gay-Luke scholasticism that you would find across Amdal, figures like Sumpa Kempo, you know, all those lamas that were at Gunlung and Kumbum Monastery around Xining, the sort of Sino-Tibetan-Mongolian frontiers, or Yonghegung in Beijing and all across Mongolia. These monks who were working in Chinese, Manchu, Tibetan, Mongolian, to both project and mediate the Qing imperial formation into local inner Asian context, but also to represent and push back based on local interests, like against the Qing, right? But through it all, you know, there's like long histories of these scholars, like engaging with Jesuits, engaging with, you know, Copernicanist, you know, models of the universe, with Christianity, with specifically also with Chinese histories of Chinese Buddhism, right? In other words, the world was already so multilingual, multi-ethnic in the plural for these scholars along the frontiers of the Qing, who had very different interests than like central Tibetans, very different interests than imperial administrators. And Zawa Damdin carries that interpretive framework forward to make sense of the Qing, I argue. Yeah. They are his primary references. And even though the narratives they told about the world no longer held, and he in some ways radically proposes like new models of global history and so on, he carries forward their interpretive impulse, which is that you need to synthesize new or emerging knowledge, right? So he couldn't just ignore new social currents, new science, right? He couldn't ignore new Western scholarship. That had to all be synthesized, had to be put into a hierarchy with his canonical sources, his authoritative sources. And he produces really radical new visions of not just Mongolian history, of Chinese history, of Mongolian history, of Islamic history, and new synthetic visions of this tradition that includes its ending, because he just doesn't think it can continue forward. And that version of events in the ruins of the Qing before the imposition of state violence, I also argue, has had really dramatic consequences for Tibetan and Mongolian refugee communities, and particularly the way he writes about the deep history of Buddhism in Asia. So this is like Mongolian Buddhism, quote unquote Mongolian Buddhism, before Genghis Khan, in this deep kind of Turkic, Mongol, deep history that he's able to kind of glean and patch together from Western sources, reading in very new ways, you know, Kanjur, Tenjur, and various, you know, all kinds of canonical sources that came down to Chinese sources. He puts together this really interesting vision of essentially like a Silk Road Mongolian history that has the Mongols bringing Buddhism not just to China, which is this old sort of Mongolian idea earlier in the Qing, but also that the Mongols brought Buddhism to Tibet, for example, that Mecca had been Mongolian territory. You know, these are things that had kind of circulated before, but he really solidifies them in these really interesting ways. And if you read historiography written by Buryats, Mongols, and Tibetans in the refugee communities outside, you know, after the waves of socialist violence, like in India and elsewhere, you'll see how widely cited his works are and how it's just taken as gospel, that this is the deep history of inter-Asian Buddhism, you know, this grand synthetic project that he had. Even if they don't really name him by name, or if he's not well known outside of Mongolia, the effect has been dramatic.
Definitely. I think that brings us very nicely to your conclusion. Where does that leave us with Zawa Damdin today?
Well, I think there's a few things. One is that we need to think about, for scholars of Buddhism and for people that are interested in cultural histories of Buddhism that can contribute to broader theoretical conversations and critical conversations about the history of the non-West generally, Zawa Damdin is emblematic because his work is doesn't reproduce all these myths of modernity that we expect and that we reproduce so often in our scholarship, also that we reproduce in our scholarship of Buddhism, that contact with Europe periodizes Asia, that it automatically leads to some kind of a series of developments, like focusing on secularization, rationalization, scientification, you know, the interiorization of Buddhism, of something called religion, and so on and so forth. In other words, a very Western-centric, Eurocentric kind of model of modernity, that it sort of spreads and diffuses out from Europe over the course of the late colonial and imperial periods. Of course that happened. That happened a lot, and in very important dramatic ways, and in ways that have been formative of the way that, say, something like Asian religiosity or histories in Asia circulate and are reproduced today. But that's not the only thing that was happening. And in fact, it may not have been even the primary thing that was happening. It may just be that that was what was happening in the works of the Suzukis and the Genden Chopels and the Sayadaws and so on, who were writing so much and were so legible and popular in the West and have rightly occupied so much scholarship. But what about all the conservative monastics, or not conservative, but like those outside of modernist discourses that were made invisible through the invention of nation and nationalism, that were sidelined and excluded as folks in Asia were inventing populations, citizenry, law, national history, national language, and so on. And so Zawadamdin is emblematic, again, of what I call a kind of counter-modern Buddhism, which has very dramatic implications, not just for Buddhist studies, but I think for Buddhist studies to enter into broader and important theoretical critical conversations in the study of Asian history, or kind of contemporary Asian history. There's many other figures like him that need to be thought of together so that we can get at all of these otherwise like topographies of the imagination, social, religious, political, economic imagination, outside of the sort of totalizing discourse of Europe, which is, and of the nation and the national subject, which is really just occupied a lot of print, and for good reason. But there's so much else out there that can help decolonize not just Buddhist studies, but even the humanities and social sciences. You know, there's a lot of, I think of like work in Islamic studies and so on, that indigenous studies, feminist histories, and so on, that have really tried to denaturalize and think beyond, you know, obviously Europe as an organizing category for the modern, or even the modern itself. You know, what lays beyond all that? Well, figures like Zawadamdin and others, especially if we think about them together, give us new language, you know, and new analytical perspectives. So that's, if this book is read, I hope people learn a bit more about what folks like Zawadamdin were working through and thinking in the revolutionary, kind of the first experiment with socialism in Asia. But I also hope more than that, that people can think with me and maybe better than me about how figures like Zawadamdin can help us develop a critique of some of the organizing categories in Buddhist studies and Asian studies, modernity studies, the history of science and religion, and so on, in ways that decenter Europe and the way we think about the non-West.
There's definitely a whole untapped goldmine of archival works that's just not been even touched upon.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm currently in Germany on a fellowship, beginning two new book projects. Well, not beginning, but really getting into. One of them, very briefly, is on biographies of Faxian, the Chinese monk pilgrim Faxian, which is actually mentioned in this book that we've been discussing in a few pages. Zawadamdin is the one who translated Faxian's travel tales, this famous early 5th century Chinese pilgrim from Chang'an, who walked across what we call the Silk Road today into Buddhist India, you know, led the way for later pilgrims like Xuanzang and so on. That text was translated into Tibetan Bhayizhao Adamdin for the first time in the 1917, I think. And it has a dramatic consequences for his own historiography of Asia, and also for refugee communities. But what's more interesting than that little corner of the story is that there was a 19th century sort of Eurasianist circuit of Faxian's, translations of Faxian's pilgrimage tale, first into French by the first person to hold a chair in Sinology and Tartary studies in the West, Jean-Pierre Abel Fémusat in Paris, who translates Faxian's pilgrimage into French for the first time into a Western language in 1834, just after he died. It's published. And this is the first time anyone in the West is reading about Buddhist India and about the biography of the Buddha tied to place. And it's a treasure trove of European knowledge about India and about Buddhism at that time, well beyond just the translation. And it's tied inexorably to the first, to the invention of Asia and Buddhism as objects of academic inquiry. And then that text in the French translations goes to Buryatia. It's translated into Mongolian by these Buryat trained ethnologists, trained by the Russian Tsarists. You know, it goes into Tibetan with Zhao Adamdin. And I want to track the circulation of Faxian's texts and the way that it enters into Inner Asia as a way of looking at these multiple ways that Faxian's pilgrimage tale produces Asia and Buddhism as objects of inquiry differently, whether it's in the Russian Academy, whether it's in France, whether it's in monastic colleges, whether it's among refugee communities in the 1960s and 70s, mm-hmm. and also produce like an annotated translation of this version of Faxian's tale, which is supplemented by the Kala Chakra Tantra and Abhidharma and all sorts of other stuff. So that's one project. And then very briefly, the second project is on what I'm calling public culture in Inner Asia over the course of the Qing, and in some ways extending what I think is on display with Zhao Adamdin's life back into the 18th century and leading up until the mid-20th century, and trying to think about intellectual exchanges, inter-Asian circuits of knowledge, and so on, beyond these really problematic categories we need to think beyond, like the West and the non-West, mm-hmm. modernity and tradition, you know, religion, so on. So, and I want to think about the ways that a kind of public culture, a public intellectual culture existed where representations about everything from astronomy, geography, philosophy, and so on was sort of circuiting, beginning with Tsongpa Kempo in the 18th century and sort of ending with a generation of scholars who were leaving Tibet in the 1950s in the wake of the Chinese invasion and writing in the 1960s. So it's kind of a that project's a bit further off, but that's what I'm working on right now in terms of like developing the theory and the questions.
Sounds so exciting. We'll see. Materialize, we'll have to have you back on the show.
I would love to.
Well, that's taken up plenty of your time for today. Thank you so much for being on the show. That was just amazing to hear you talk about your work beyond just reading it.
And thank you.
Can't wait to have you back.
Thank you so much for your interest and for the questions.